Morning, everyone. We're going to get started this morning. Today, it is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Navalet Thompson, who is a very good friend of mine. We were interns in residence together many years ago. Dr. Thompson was born in Jamaica and graduated high school there and then went to Howard University, where she went to college and medical school. She subsequently did her internship and residency again in at Jackson Memorial University of Miami Hospitals in Miami Beach, in the city of Miami. She stayed on after she did her endocrine fellowship there as a faculty and assistant professor in the Department of Medicine before leaving in 1994 to go into clinical practice in Broward County. She has been practicing at the Holy Cross Medical Group since 1998 as a clinical endocrinologist. She's always been interested in teaching, and in addition to the clinical practice of endocrinology. In 2015, she joined the faculty of the newly formed internal medicine residency program of the University of Miami at Holy Cross. It is my pleasure to welcome her. She's going to give us a talk on incidental lomas in endocrinology.
Thanks, John. Anybody wants war stories about internship at Jackson in the 80s, see me after the talk. I have lots of stories about Dr. Rubin. Okay. I don't know. It's kind of spread out. I don't know if you guys wanted to come closer. This talk should be can be very interactive. If you have questions in the middle of it, feel free to ask. The next few minutes, and I'll try to make sure everybody gets out on time. We have a lot of slides, but they're all in your handout. And if I don't get through all of them, then, as I said, they are all pretty much there. And towards the end, those are pretty self-explanatory anyway. The topic is very important because all of us, regardless of our specialty, obtain imaging studies, and it's not uncommon these days with the proliferation of procedures that we have available that we find incidental lesions in various endocrine organs. And so the dilemma is always, what do we do with these? And I think as generalists, internists, and other subspecialists, there's some basic principles that it's important that we all are familiar with, and it's then to know when to call your friendly endocrinologist. We're going to go through the more common ones that we see, thyroid, adrenal, and pituitary. I have no disclosures. So our first discussion will be on thyroid incidental lomas, and it's common you send a patient for carotid ultrasound, comes back, there's a lesion in one of the thyroid lobes, or they go for an MRI of the neck after a motor vehicle accident. These are common situations that they're found, or they do a PET scan for a procedure. And so it's important to know what is the differential diagnosis, what's the diagnostic approach to these, and what are the differential diagnoses that one should consider when you encounter these findings. So the first thing to make clear is that thyroid nodules are extremely common in the general population. So we are going to encounter these all the time. So in 2016, I thought I was doing the pointer here. In 2016, it was reported there were 63,000 new cases of thyroid cancer in the U.S., and the numbers for 2017 are pretty close to 60,000 as well. Let me go back. There are 300,000 new palpable thyroid nodules detected annually. For some reason, this keeps going back on me. And incidental nodules are found in about 13% of carotid Dopplers. I'm not sure what I'm touching, why this is going back. Okay. And discrete nodules are found about 6 to 7% on thyroid ultrasounds. What is clear, however, is that we're only palpating a fraction of these nodules. About less than 10% of nodules are picked up on exam. Vast majority are found on thyroid ultrasounds. And what is clear as well is that the incident prevalence of nodules will increase with age. I think autopsy studies have about over 60% of 90-year-olds will be found with thyroid nodules. Nodules are also more commonly found in women and in individuals from areas where iodine is deficient. Very common. This is to remind us of our thyroid anatomy. Thyroid is a little butterfly gland that sits at the base of the neck, between the sternal notch and the thyroid cartilage. And most normal adults, you don't palpate a normal thyroid. So if you're examining the neck and you feel something, it's likely that they have a goiter and or a nodule. So it's important to follow that up. The good news is that most of the nodules that we'll find in the thyroid are benign, 90 to 95%, and they're various adenomas or cysts. there are about 5 to 10% of these dodges will become malignant, and these you don't want to miss. The good news, however, is that most of them are well-differentiated papillary thyroid carcinomas that are fairly low risk and have a generally good prognosis with a 20-year survival of about 90%. Most of these tend to be small and therefore quite manageable. However, there are other thyroid malignant nodules that we don't want to miss, certainly follicular, medullary, often parts of a familial syndrome. The worst case scenario is anaplastic. I actually just diagnosed one of these 2 weeks ago on somebody who had a multinodular goiter that had been followed initially, but then he was lost to follow-up, presented with a mass and voice changes, and this thing is infiltrating his trachea. So they're rare, thankfully, but you don't ever want to miss those. Thyroid lymphomas, commonly found in the setting of autoimmune thyroid disease. So these patients will often have a history of Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and then they have a growing goiter with lots of adenopathy, and they respond extremely well to chemo. These are not surgical candidates. And then thyroid metastases from other primary source, most common, kidney, lung, and breast. So the patient would normally have a history. Again, very rare, but don't want to miss those. So when we encounter a patient with a nodule in the thyroid, there are some basic things that we need to do. The first thing is most of these patients are asymptomatic. So the absence of symptoms should not dissuade you from doing a further workup on these patients. We'll talk about the indications for fine needle aspiration later, but there's some basic historical information that you want to obtain, certainly if there's a family history of thyroid disease, history of prior head or neck treatment, radiation especially, if there's evidence of growth, voice changes, very important. And on exam, you want to note the location, the consistency. Is it rubbery? Is it cystic? Is it firm, fixed? Estimate whether or not there's cervical adenopathy. That would be a suspicious finding. And certainly, you want to assess the patient for signs and symptoms of hyper or hypothyroidism. The factors that are troubling that would make you more suspicious of these nodules, certainly if there's a history of prior head or neck irradiation. Way back in the 50s, they used to radiate for acne and adenoids, and so we still find people who have had that exposure. And so it's important to ask about that history. And it's remote, so they often don't remember it. Family history of medullary thyroid or MEN syndrome should certainly raise your suspicion for medullary thyroid carcinoma. And extremes of age. If these nodules are found in someone under 20 or over 70, usually much more suspicious for cancer. Men, certainly also more suspicious for cancer. And if on follow-up there's evidence of growing a nodule or firm consistency adenopathy we mentioned earlier, and of course persistent voice changes, all suspicious findings for these nodules being a malignant nature. The initial laboratory evaluation, at the very minimum, a TSH is indicated in any patient you find a thyroid nodule. Certainly, if the TSH is low, then you'll be more suspicious. There's subclinical hyperthyroidism, and you want to get the peripheral T4 and T3 levels. If the TSH is elevated, then you want to screen for Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which may present with either an atrophic thyroid or a goitrous, lumpy, bumpy type heterogeneous nodular thyroid. So it's important to assess if there's that history. Measurement of serum thyroglobulin in a patient with a thyroid nodule is not very helpful. We do use that test to monitor patients who have had treatment for thyroid cancer, definitive treatment. It's a good marker for a recurrence, but it's not useful in a patient with an intact thyroid and just a nodule. And calcitonin, again, should be measured if there is a family history of medullary thyroid carcinoma. So the basic evaluation, regardless of the imaging study that one finds a nodule on a thyroid, it's important to do a baseline thyroid ultrasound. It's the most important test to confirm the presence of the nodule. Oftentimes, there may be other nodules that were not picked up on that initial imaging study. It characterizes the nodule, and we'll go into what some of those characteristics are that we look for. And again, detecting other nodules as well as looking for cervical adenopathy. So a baseline ultrasound is the preferred study for assessment of the thyroid nodule, regardless of what that initial imaging study that you incidentally found it on. And it's the best test to follow change over time because our hands are not very sensitive. And we measured, mentioned earlier that a TSH is important to do a baseline functional assessment. So this was a report from a consensus by the Society of Radiology that looked at various studies to assess what are the ultrasound features that are suggestive of malignancy. And what is clear here is that there's extremely variable sensitivity, specificity, and predictive value of these studies. However, for example, a nodule, none of them are very sensitive and at the same time very predictive, and so as an individual feature. However, if you look at multiple features, two or more of these features together, the predictive value for this nodule being cancerous goes up. So the most sensitive, probably a solid consistency. However, it's not very predictive. And so no single one of these features is often by itself enough. And so you want your ultrasonographer to describe more in detail, you know, the other findings. Are there microcalcifications, hypoechogenicity, irregular margins, solid intranodular vascularity? Now, one of the things that's not commonly known is this tall greater than wide. And this is basically an increased diameter in the AP direction when the patient is lying down. There was a meta-analysis that found that this particular finding has the highest odds ratio of predicting the nodule as being malignant. So that's basically features that we would look at. The other interesting thing is on color Doppler, the finding of intranodular vascularity also had a predictive value for malignancy, particularly if it's in the central portion of the nodule. And so vascularity is often described depending on whether it's peripheral or centrally located. And we'll go into some of these features in a minute. So in the next few slides, I wanted to just give some examples of what these look like on ultrasound. I'm not sure how well this projects. But the normal thyroid is actually hyperechoic compared to the surrounding strap muscles. And so nodules in the thyroid are often described as whether or not they're iso-hypo or hyperechoic relative to the normal thyroid. And one of the findings of benign nodules is this finding of a halo, a hypoechoic halo around the nodule. When you see that, that is usually suggestive of a benign nodule. This nodule, if you look at the here, about at least 50% of the nodule consists of microcysts, and that finding is actually suggestive of a benign nodule. However, if they're large, we would still want to biopsy them. But typically, spongiform nodules in which over half of the nodule consists of these microcysts are usually benign. So we're not as concerned, especially if they're small. Now, the finding of punctate calcifications within the nodules are always suspicious. These are usually due to the presence of stemoma bodies, which are a hallmark feature in papillary thyroid carcinoma. So if you have a nodule that has irregular margins and these punctate calcifications, that's a nodule you definitely want a tissue diagnosis because that's more suspicious. Again, combining two or more of these features together increases the likelihood of these nodules being cancerous. This nodule on initial view seemed to be cystic. It's very clear fluid-filled sac, which usually if you get a pure cyst, these are benign, and we don't usually biopsy those unless they're growing and are at risk for rupture, then you may want to aspirate them. But most times a simple cyst is benign, we don't do anything about it. However, it's careful to look closely because on this particular one in the corner was a solid component. And so this is a complex nodule with both cystic and solid features, which would require ultrasound-guided biopsy to make sure you got tissue from here, not just draining the fluid from here, to make sure you get a good diagnosis. We mentioned earlier about vascularity, and that this is an example of a color Doppler showing probably on this one more peripheral, although some of this seem to be inside. But on the true intranodular, the whole thing is filled out. And so this finding is predictive as well, particularly, as I said, when it is in more centrally located. And the vascularity types are described as types 1, 2, 5, depending on whether or not there's no vascularity versus vascularity that's peripherally predominantly or cystic central predominantly or both. This nodule also highlighted another feature we talked about, is the AP diameter being much bigger than the transverse diameter. And that's a suggestive finding that we mentioned earlier that may suggest a more malignant nature to this nodule. So I don't know how well this projects, but this is a summary of the ultrasound features, looking at the risk for malignant features depending on the findings. So we mentioned earlier, pure cysts are usually benign and we're not as concerned. Less than 1% of those are malignant. Then this is the risk. It's hard for me to read this one. But the risk goes up with the finding. And we mentioned spongiform nodules, nodules that are partially cystic with normal borders are less suspicious. Nodules that are low suspicion, again, hyperechoic, solid, but regular, you see the halo there. Those are typically benign features that you wouldn't worry as much about. These are partially cystic nodule, again, with solid portions of it that you would still biopsy, but this is low risk. The risk goes up with the findings of hyperechoic, solid here, regular margins, again, there. And then the highest risk nodules are the nodules we mentioned, calcifications. These are hypoechoic nodules, margins not very well clear. Again, nodules where there is extrusion or at least some evidence of extrathyroidal extension. This is probably one that shows it a little more clearly. And in this one, there's a calcific rim. There's this extrusion of tissue. These are all suspicious findings that will certainly make you want to get the biopsy to rule that out. And of course, the findings of irregular margins with surrounding adenopathy will raise your suspicion as well. So that's just a little bit of radiology this early in the morning. Okay. The other finding I want to highlight was the finding of nodules on PET scans. Oftentimes, we're doing PET scans in patients with known malignancies, and it's not uncommon to see focal uptake in the thyroid. Well, when you see that, do get a thyroid biopsy because it's likely to have a secondary primary cancer. I had a patient with colon cancer, and in her case, hers was a papillary thyroid, totally unrelated to her colon cancer. So the finding on PET, a focal uptake in a euthyroid patient with a maximal SUV max that's greater than 5 should raise your suspicion. Now, sometimes on PET, you may see a diffuse uptake, which is typically associated with Hashimoto's patients, and those patients we don't have to biopsy. So it's the finding of the focal uptake on these PET scans that raises your suspicion. Okay, so just to give you a little bit overview on the approach, so you discover an incidental thyroid on a PET or CT, you definitely want to get your TSH and ultrasound, and the rest of the workup depends on what that TSH was. If the TSH is low, as we mentioned earlier, that suggests subclinical hyperthyroidism, so that's the indication to do a scan. You do not need to do a scan in a patient with a nodule that's normal functioning. It's not going to change the fact that what you need is really a fine needle, and that's something that comes up all the time with non-endocrinologists, and oftentimes the radiologists will say correlate with nuclear imaging and you feel obligated to do the scan. Don't. If the TSH is normal, the scan isn't going to change anything. Not only that, a lot of times these nodules are small and they do not pick up on the scan, so it's really a wasted test that exposes the patient unnecessarily and delays the true workup. So if the TSH is low, then yes, go ahead and get that nuclear scan to assess for autonomy, which may be a toxic adenoma, a toxic multinodular goiter, or Graves' disease. However, you can have a cold nodule in the setting of Graves' disease. So if you see a cold nodule on that scan, even though the TSH initially was low and that led to the scan, if you see an incidental cold nodule, then definitely you would want to biopsy that nodule. In a patient with normal TSH, again, you're going to go straight to the FNA. If the nodule is big enough or has any of those ultrasound features we mentioned that are troubling. And a high TSH, definitely screen for Hashimoto's. A lot of these patients do have nodular appearing thyroid. However, if there's a dominant nodule in that lumpy, bumpy, heterogeneous band, you want to biopsy that. Oftentimes it shows lymphocytic thyroiditis, which is the pathologic appearance of Hashimoto's. So the fine needle criteria. Again, usually we don't not biopsy nodules less than 1 centimeter, although some of the new guidelines said if the setting is right, if the patient has an underlying malignancy and you're concerned about metastases. However, generally, if the nodules are less than 1, we follow them. A nodule greater than 1 centimeter that's hypoechoic with the suspicious features we mentioned, by all means, you need to do a FNA on those nodules. For the nodules that are in that intermediate category, the isoechoic nodules, hyperechoic nodules, however, they're larger. That may be worth assessing as well, because remember, it wasn't zero risk, it was just lower risk. So the bigger nodules with these less suspicious features you'd want to measure. And the spongiform nodules, unless they're over 2 centimeters, we don't usually biopsy those. FNA criteria, we mentioned earlier, and we showed you examples of those suspicious features, irregular margins, the presence of microcalcification, the taller than wide appearance. If there's evidence of extrathyroidal extension or extrusion through the rim, definitely suspicious features, must do FNA on those. So fine needle is usually, the findings are described using the Bethesda system for reporting cytopathology. And usually if the FNA report comes back as benign, the chances of malignancy is very small. Definitely if it comes back malignant, suspicious for malignancy, very, very likelihood that's what it is. This is our troubling area. They're oftentimes the case where it comes back atypical of unknown significance or undetermined ATEST, we refer to it. About 20 to 25% of those are malignant. So the question is, do we re-biopsy? And what tools do we have that will help aid our decision-making about whether or not to send these patients to surgery? Previously, we would either re-biopsy it or follow the patient. If it's a patient who's extremely nervous and anxious, we may err on the side of electively taking out that side. And if the pathology on the specimen removed confirms cancer, then they go back for a complete thyroidectomy. Well, thankfully, we have some new tools that are helping us with our decision-making, and it's the assessment of genetic testing on the actual biopsy tissue. And so there is a test called Afirma and ThyroSeq that is helping us in these undetermined cases. And in our facility, if the FNA comes back HS, they default to sending this. You don't have to go send a patient for a repeat biopsy to do it. The pathologist would automatically default and send it out for these genetic testing. It turns out 70% of patients with papillary thyroid harbor specific gene mutations or gene rearrangements that can be tested for in these tissue. So if they come back on these tests with evidence of or suspicious for gene arrangement, and there's a whole alphabet soup of genes that are associated with increased risk for thyroid cancer, most commonly known as the BRAF, B-R-A-F, and that carries a much higher likelihood of these being more aggressive tumors. So if they atypia comes back positive for these gene rearrangements, you definitely are going to send this patient for not just a partial thyroidectomy, but a total thyroidectomy. And the same thing for those nodules in between nodules that are suspicious for follicular neoplasm, but they're not seeing enough mitoses or whatever on the tissue to make the call for malignancy. Those are prime candidates for doing that genetic testing. So this has been a fairly new addition to our armamentarium for assessing these patients, who needs to go to surgery right away and who we can follow with serial ultrasounds to see if these nodules grow. For the patients that come back outright malignant, there's no question they're going to go for thyroidectomy. And the extent of the surgery may depend on either, the suspicious features we mentioned or what the surgeon sees at the time of surgery. So I wanted to just highlight some of these issues with a case. And this is a 33-year-old male noted to have a palpable enlargement of the right side of his thyroid. Ultrasound reveals a 3.1-centimeter nodule, smooth borders. TSH was 0.1, which is suppressed, or low, at least. He reports a history of symptomatic palpitations, weight loss. This is clearly too obvious. Despite an increase in his appetite, he's not taking any medications, and he has no problems with swallowing or his voice. The question is, what do you do next? Do you perform an FNA biopsy of the right-sided nodule? Do you administer I-131? Do you refer the patient to the surgeon? Do you start methimazole, or do you do a radioiodine scan and uptake? And this is for the residents. And I know you have your handout, so I'm just going to keep going. And basically, in this patient, you want to do the scan. We mentioned earlier, the TSH was suppressed. This is when the scan is appropriate. And so if the TSH is normal, please do not scan, no matter what the radiology report says. Another thyroid case. This is actually from MGSAB. So for the trainees, you need to know this stuff. 42-year-old woman went for an annual physical. She feels well, no past medical history, no meds, no family history. Physical exam vitals are fine. However, you palpate a possible right thyroid nodule. And sometimes it's very hard if you don't do this every day. You know, it just feels lumpy. And a lot of times I like to examine the patient from behind so I can feel both sides concurrently. Sometimes you may need to have them with a glass of water to let them swallow, because if you don't swallow, you don't often feel that there's something moving under your hand. But it's important to follow that up, of course, with the thyroid ultrasound. So the lab test in this patient is normal, or TSH is 1.7. Thyroid ultrasound reveals a 1.5 centimeter hypoechoic nodule with internal calcifications. So the mix-up makes it very clear what needs to be done in this patient. And it says, which of the following is the most appropriate? Do you do a CT? Do you do an FNA? Do you put the patient on levothyroxine? Do you measure thyroglobulin? Or do you do a scan? Again, ultrasound is the most sensitive test for nodules. CT is not going to add anything, so this is a waste of money. Levothyroxine therapy for normal nodules is no longer standard of care to do suppression therapy because of the potential negative effects of levothyroxine. And we mentioned earlier serothyroglobulin in a patient with a normal intact thyroid is not diagnostic and it's not indicated. And her TSH was normal, so there was no reason to do a thyroid scan. So it's very clear this patient has very suspicious features based on what we discussed. She needs an FNA. Okay, so that was it for thyroid. We're going to shift gears and go a little lower. Make sure we're doing good on time. So adrenals come up all the time. Everybody gets a CT scan when they go to the emergency room for belly pain. So we are constantly encountering this phenomena. The incidence or prevalence of adrenal incidentaloma is depends on the source. In autopsy series range from between 1.4 and 2.9. There was one Mayo Clinic series looking at over 60,000 CTs over 5 years, and they came up with a prevalence of 0.4%. In a patient with known malignancies, you'd expect it to be higher because these patients can have mets. I mentioned to you that lung cancer patients are one of the ones that can metastasize to these endocrine glands. Thyroid is one. It turns out they also commonly metastasize to adrenals. However, about 1 out of 4 of these nodules in a patient with known lung cancer was benign. So it's not always the case that it represents a met. So adrenal tumors are incidentally discovered between 1 and 10% of adults. Fortunately, most of these are benign. However, you can have primary adrenal malignancy or extra adrenal mets, as we mentioned. And most of these end up being benign and non-functional, meaning they're not actively producing any hormones. In contrast, however, about 10 to 15% of these can autonomously secrete hormones, so that when we test biochemically, there is evidence of functionality, but they have no overt clinical signs and symptoms. And this is a particular area of concern because of the finding that these patients do have increased cardiometabolic risk for heart disease, diabetes, and osteoporotic fractures. So it's important that all patients who are found with incidental adrenal nodules be evaluated to see if they're malignant and specifically if they're functioning. So the differential diagnosis for patients with the benign nodules, as I said, most of them are benign. Myelolipoma, these are high fatty looking masses, sometimes can be quite large, but they're very benign. Neuroblastoma, ganglioneuroma, the list goes on. You can also have infections involving the adrenals, which are usually non-functional. The functional ones we don't want to miss, certainly the patient with a single aldosterone-producing tumor or Kahn syndrome should be looked. These tend to be actually quite small, too, but so it's important to do the biochemical workup. Cortisol producing, they could be micro or macronodular disease. And of course, the big bugaboo, you don't ever want to miss the pheo patient. So thankfully, most of these patients with pheos are benign. However, you can have malignant pheos about 10% of the time. So the other 5% of adrenal incidentalomas that are malignant, again, can be primary adrenal carcinoma, metastatic cancer from a non-adrenal primary, lymphomas, lung cancer, breast cancer, kidneys. The three that keeps coming up for these metastases to endocrine system, lung, kidney, breast, in various orders. But those are the top three that can metastasize to the adrenal. And you can actually have functioning malignant tumors. adrenal carcinoma that's actually making these hormones, and it could be any of the various hormones that the adrenal makes. And about 10% of FEAs are malignant, so it's important to do the biochemistry. So the key approach in patients with adrenal incidentaloma is to answer these questions. Is there evidence of malignancy? Is there evidence of adrenal hormone excess? You want to assess first the clinical phenotype. Does anything in the history and physical exam suggest there's evidence for functionality? And we'll go through some of those symptoms in a minute. Then you want to look at the biochemistry, the lab work, looking for evidence of these adrenal hormones in excess. And then one of the big feature here with adrenal masses that we don't want to miss is the radiographic phenotype, which one author feels that this is actually probably the most important thing to look at in patients with adrenal masses. And our radiology colleagues are catching on, and when they describe these reports, it's important that you read that carefully. So again, this is Adrenal Imaging 101. I'm not very good at looking at x-rays, so these basic things help. So this is the patient's feet are towards you. This is the liver, so this is their right side. The spleen, so those are the big landmarks, and the stomach. So you have the IVC here, the aorta. So this is the right adrenal. It has this wishbone look shape, and on the left, it's more like an upside down Y. So that's when you get your CT imaging to look at that. And those are the areas you're going to look at to see where the adrenals are. On the non-contrast CT, it's turning out that the attenuation is often helpful in telling us which ones are more likely to be malignant. Benign tumors usually have a high lipid content and are usually low attenuation. So the lower the Hausfeld unit, usually less than 10, more likely that's benign. Hausfeld units that are higher are more suspicious and they're less lipid filled nodules. This doesn't project very well. This is actually a large myelolipoma. On top, you see it's squishing the kidney a little bit on that. And those are, of course, all lipid, or mainly lipid containing. And so those are benign, no matter how big they get. On the other side, this is a very large, ugly looking tumor on the left adrenal. It has cystic or hemorrhagic areas in it, much more suspicious. The less lipid-containing ones are actually FEO, tend to be, has a high Hausfeld unit. Of course, adrenal cortical carcinoma or metastases, and there are examples of lipid-poor adenomas that may also have a higher Hausfeld unit. So those numbers that the radiologist report is important when it comes to interpreting whether or not this mass on the adrenal is benign or not. This is probably the most important slide in this talk in the adrenal part of the talk, and I'll quickly go through it. It looks busy, but it really has a lot of useful information that you need. And for the trainees, everything you need to know about adrenal masses for the boards is on that slide. So size is really important. Unlike thyroid, in which size wasn't as important a predictor, size is important when it comes to assessing whether or not an adrenal mass is benign or malignant. So it turns out the benign adenomas usually are small, less than 3 centimeters, compared to the carcinomas, which are usually quite large, generally of a 4. Actually, these are the ones that show up over 6 centimeters. FEOs typically are large as well. And then metastases are quite variable. You can have very tiny metastases. Most of the time, they're actually under 3 centimeters. So the size, the important thing is this patient would have a known history of a primary malignancy, so you need to be suspicious. And these tend to be bilateral as well, so that helps you. Shape, the benign adenomas are round, they're smooth margins, while the carcinomas, as you would expect, very irregular, very not well demarcated margins. FEOs, even though they're large, they tend to be round with clear margins. So that's the difference between the FEOs and the carcinomas. And metastases, again, irregular with unclear margins. The texture, usually homogeneous for benign, and everything else is heterogeneous. FEOs typically have very cystic-looking areas, so it's important to distinguish that from metastases that may be hemorrhagic as well. And the laterality, usually the benign nodules are solitary, one-sided. Carcinomas typically are as well. Of course, 10% of FEOs can be bilateral, but again, usually these are unilateral, and METs, most often they're bilateral because it's in the setting of diffuse cancer. The attenuation non-contrast CT we mentioned earlier, the house field units for the adrenal adenomas that are benign less than 10, while everything else is usually high. And generally over 10, but usually even higher. The vascularity on contrast is important. Again, not very vascular for the benign adenomas, but for everything else is vascular. And one of the features that is looked at is how fast the contrast washes out after you give IV contrast. And it turns out the benign adenomas wash out very quickly, more than 50% at 10 minutes, while the others are much slower. So again, when the radiologist describes, you know, the pre- and post-contrast CT findings, it's important to pay attention to those things in terms of trying to decide is this malignant or not. And then MRI can sometimes be helpful, particularly for distinguishing pheos, and usually very hyperintense, the most hyperintense on T2-weighted image, and that's one of the things that we can use to distinguish these functional pheos versus benign adenomas. Again, if there's evidence of necrosis, hemorrhage, and calcification, very rare for the benign and variable present for the others. And growth rate is important. Benign adenomas are extremely stable over time. They can grow, but they're usually quite slow, less than a centimeter per year. The most rapidly growing is the adrenal carcinoma. They can just change overnight. The pheos tend to be slower growing as well, and of course the metastases are variable. So I wanted to show a few examples. Again, I don't know how well this projects, but this is an example. Okay, this is an example of a pheo. It's quite large in the adrenal here, and has, if you look closely, there are some little cystic areas, which is not uncommon in patients with pheos. As opposed to this benign adenoma, it's very rounded, very nice margins. And this one is a carcinoma, which, again, very, very large with hemorrhagic area, cystic areas in it. And these are rapid growers. This is a follow-up CT with serial imaging. So this one, this is the initial adenoma here. And you can see on follow-up, this is clearly growing. And these are patients with metastases. In this patient, this is a benign pheo, but it's clearly growing. And you can see here as it got bigger, it got more cystic. So definitely if the serial imaging is important to follow these patients. And this is a rapidly growing adrenal carcinoma. This is the initial tumor, and this is what it looks like on follow-up. So again, when you see these adenomas, it's important to do serial imaging to see whether or not they're growing as a sign of malignancy. So going back to the clinical features, if you look on these, I don't know. When I look at this, this is half of my patients every day. They're, you know, overweight, they're hyperglycemic diabetic. As an endocrinologist, I'm seeing these patients. They're hypertensive, may or may not have osteoporosis. So these are not uncommon for non-adrenal patients, but it's the combined features along with their image features that will be helpful in telling us which ones we need to be suspicious for. Certainly, if they have overt cortisol excess, the central obesity, one of the things that is not commonly described is the presence of proximal myopathy. They'll tell you they can't get out of a chair without holding on, they can't climb stairs. That's a hallmark feature that you would be suspicious for, that there may be hypercortisolism. Mood disorders are common. I actually diagnosed a patient with Cushing's based on his osteoporosis. It was a 40-year-old young man, no other history, didn't look overtly Cushingoid, but was a radiology tech who they had a new bone density, and he asked to get screened. And lo and behold, his bones were extremely thin. They ended up sending him for further workup, and sure enough, it was Cushing's. And in looking back at pictures of him on the beach, you could see some of these subtle features. So, you know, don't hesitate to work up your patients with accelerated osteoporosis out of proportion for their age, because you could be missing some serious disease like Cushing's. For catecholamine excess, obviously, some of these patients will have paroxysms. Not all of them do. Not all of them present with severe hypertension. But if it's there with palpitations, anxiety, sweats, you'll be more suspicious and will definitely do the workup. And, of course, the aldosterone patient, hypertension, hypokalemia. I just had a case. This lady had gone about 14 years with hypertension that wasn't very well controlled. At one point was on up to 7 medications. She only had one episode of spontaneous hypokalemia during a hospitalization, and nobody put the 2 and 2 together. And we just worked her up, ended up going all the way to adrenal vein sampling, and turned out she did lateralize in this tiny little adrenal adenoma. And these aldosteronomas tend to be quite small. And so because nodules are very common and as we get older in the adrenals, it was important for us to show not only that she had the biochemistry, but then she lateralized to the side with that tiny little nodule. So she's getting her adrenalectomy. So again, be on the lookout. These are common patients you'll see in your clinic. And you know, if the blood pressure is not well controlled, needing multiple medications, be suspicious. So the patients with adrenal incidentalomas that are, we mentioned that size is very helpful in telling us if they're malignant, and so is radiographic findings. Biopsy, percutaneous biopsy of these nodules is very rarely needed. Most often it may be considered in patients with a known malignancy in whom we're trying to see whether or not they have metastases, particularly if the finding on the biopsy will alter your treatment. The hallmark thing, though, you must first rule out pheo to avoid precipitating a hypertensive crisis. So you don't ever want to put a needle in one of these without knowing if they have pheos. Okay. Indications for surgery in these patients, any functioning adrenal adenoma, regardless of size, usually is recommended for surgery. Clearly, if we confirm that they have functionality, particularly pheo, and lesions over 6 centimeters. Some theories say if they're over 4, but more often I think there's more agreement that anybody with a nodule adrenal mass over 6 centimeters should go to surgery because of the higher likelihood of malignancy. Clearly, following up these patients, you want to be doing serial CTs. What is not very clear in the literature is very good prospective studies telling us what the frequency of that monitoring should be. Generally, CTs would be done at 6 months, 12 months, 24 months. However, if the image features are suspicious for malignancy, you may want to do more like 3 months to see if they're one of those rapid growers. The big dilemma in these patients are the patients with subclinical hypercortisolism, and more we're recognizing this as a phenomena. So we're going to go through this case quickly that highlights this issue. This is a 46-year-old premenopausal woman who's in a car accident, no known medical conditions. She was brought to the ER, complaining of abdominal pain, so of course she gets a CT. No hemorrhage or injuries. This was a non-contrast CT, which is the quickest, easiest to tell us that. However, on that CT was an incidental 2.2-centimeter right adrenal mass, 5 house field units on enhanced density. And the question is, what do you tell her? What is this? So we're going to do some further workup. So on their clinical picture, she had no symptoms to suggest hyperfunctioning, no symptoms such as hypercortisolism, pheo, or aldo, and she was in hirsute. She had no weight loss, no abdominal distension, and no evidence of any metastatic cancer at this point. So this was felt unrevealing. So the question is, the 2.2-centimeter nodule on enhanced density of 5-HU on CT is most suggestive of what? And you're all experts of this, because I told you that very busy slide told you everything you need to do. So it wasn't very fatty looking. The myelolipomas are usually in the negative Hausfield units because they're so highly fat content. Pheos, generally higher intensity, as I mentioned, attenuation. Metastatic lung cancer to adrenal, again, usually high attenuation, and so would be adrenal cortical carcinoma. So we're left with this being a benign adenoma. So this is a picture. Again, we already did the 101 slide, so we already know here's our wishbone, here's our upside down Y. And in this patient, this was a little lower cut, I think. This was her adenoma in the right adrenal, very well circumscribed, nothing suspicious about it, it's homogeneous. So based on what we discussed before, she has a nodule, it's 2.2, so it's less than 4, so in the benign category, attenuation was low, no irregular borders, no homogeneous content, no. So everything on a non-contrast CT suggests that this is a benign lesion. So just to review the workup for these patients with adrenal incidentalomas, We mentioned needing to rule out functionality. So all of these patients should have a overnight 1 milligram overnight dexamethasone suppression test. They get 1 milligram at 11 p.m. and you do the morning cortisol at 8. And what you're looking for, if there's evidence of no function, is that the AM cortisol should be less than 1.8. If there's in between 1.9 and 5, this may suggest subclinical cortisol secretion. And clearly, if it's 5 or above, then this is an autonomously functioning glucocorticoid tumor. For the primary ALDO patients, certainly in the presence of hypertension and or hypokalemia, you want to do the ALDO-renin ratio. And you're looking for a suppressed renin with a ratio of 20 or more to suggest hyperaldo. Generally, you would follow that up with either a salt suppression test to confirm autonomy. And then for the FIO, I really think all patients, I don't know why they put almost here, but all patients with adrenal adenomas should have a screen for FIO. And this can be a plasma or a 24-hour urine for total infractionated metanephrines and catecholamines. And these are not subtle. They're usually, you know, 2 to 4 times the upper limit. So they're not your patient with upper limits of 700 or some, you know, they're, you know, borderline. If they have it, you'll see that. And then for the androgen excess, these are you rarely present in the absence of overt clinical symptoms. So if you have a woman who is hirsute with a mass, you definitely want to check androgenics. And you're looking for any elevation. So that's the basic screen for those adrenal adenomas in terms of assessing functionality. So in this patient, she did have her overnight dex suppression. And in endocrinology, we like to repeat testing. So she had twice, and both times she was in the elevated range. She did have a high-dose dex suppression, which was also elevated. Usually, you're looking for at least a 50% decrease from baseline in the cortisol when you do the high dose. And then her 24 urine cortisol was right at the cutoff. So a lot of times these patients are not, these subtle patients are not that dramatic. But the combined features is what we look at. So she had all three of the commonly used tests to look for glucocorticoid autonomy. And her midnight salivary cortisol was elevated on 2 of the 4 tests. You know, normally we do this at least 3 times to get a finding. The rest of her workup was unrevealing, so it suggests here that this lady does have some autonomous cortisol secretion, even in the absence of overt clinical features. So she has a benign adenoma that appears to be autonomously secreting cortisol, but she has no clinical signs of hypercortisolism. And the dilemma in endocrinology is, should we send these people for surgery? And there's some studies that help to indicate that we probably should consider this for some patients. So this lady, some additional information, blood pressure was fine, fasting glucose was fine, but A1C was actually in the pre-diabetic range. And importantly, this premenopausal woman had osteoporosis in her spine. She definitely had osteopenia in her hips. So she was having some metabolic effects of her subclinical cortisol excess. So the decision in this case was to go for laparoscopic right adrenalectomy. She did get, or at least was ordered for IV hydrocortisone. And the reason why you'd want to cover these patients normally is that there's often relative suppression of the other adrenal. So when you take out the one with the tumor, if they have suppression of the other gland, they may develop transient adrenal insufficiency, so you want to be ready to cover them. This lady didn't end up needing that for reason, but you could see biochemically she was on the low side post-op, no symptoms, and then eventually her adrenals recover. In some of the patients with more overt Cushing's, when you do these adrenalectomies, they actually may remain adrenally insufficient for months, up to a year. So on average, it's about 9 months. So you would definitely send them home with cortisol replacement and taper that over time and reassess with adrenal stimulation testing to make sure they've recovered function in the remaining gland. So the issue with these patients, though, is, you know, they present with comorbidities that have potential negative effects. They are hypertension, they may develop diabetes, dyslipidemia, osteoporosis we mentioned. I'm going to rush through the next few slides. This was a study that looked at patients with adrenal incidentalomas and the incidence of vertebral fractures. And autonomous cortisol secretion was associated with a tenfold higher risk for vertebral fractures. This is major. And so it's important that we not leave the, you know, we monitor and work these patients up to find out. The next few studies, slides, basically were, this was another study, was a study, three-year cohort study in the Annals that looked at the presence of non-functioning adrenal tumors and the development of cardiometabolic risk factors. So in no adrenals, they had about 11.7%, and in patients with non-functional adrenal tumors, even though their post-dex cortisol was not elevated, slight increased risk for diabetes, and in the patients that did have subclinical hypercortisolism, definitely higher risk. So this correlated with size of the tumor and as well as the post-dex cortisol levels. This doesn't project very well. I'm going to run through this one. This was I believe this was a meta-analysis and a review of studies that looked at the post-adrenalectomy outcomes of these risk factors. And even though the studies were not felt to be superior in terms of quality, there was a general trend favoring adrenalectomy to manage these patients. So in summary, the assessment for these patients with adrenal masses, we mentioned looking at their clinical phenotype, biochemistry. Again, this is the hallmark feature now that we look at their radiographic features. And if they have benign, you can follow these patients if they're smaller. The issue is what is the best frequency, and I said Q6 months for a couple years. If there's no problem after the first year or two, you may want to decrease the frequency. The big bugaboo are these patients with autonomous cortisol secretion. Some of these patients, if they're showing the recommendation, if they're younger, and younger defined as under 40, and are showing any progression of blood pressure and diabetes, you may want to consider surgery in these patients. And again, these patients with overt, it's very clear, any functioning adrenal mass should definitely go to surgery. If on serial follow-up these nodules or masses are growing, then the growth rate is over 0.5 centimeter per year or 20% increase, then you definitely should consider surgery. So close clinical follow-up, you know, these are patients you may want to make sure they are plugged in with an endocrinologist who's going to keep an eye on them. The issue as to whether or not we should repeat biochemistry is also one that is debated. However, if there are clinical signs that there is evidence of some of these metabolic features, then you would definitely want to recheck that as well. So quickly, adrenal case. This is a 47-year-old woman evaluated for incidentally discovered right adrenal mass. Blood pressure is fine, non-tender. CT non-contrast showed a 3.2 centimeter, well-circumscribed, partially cystic with high attenuation. We know what this is. Low-dose DEX was negative, no evidence of cortisol secretion. And the question is, what's the most appropriate next step in management? You're not going to send this patient to surgery right away without doing further workup. And you're clearly not going to put a needle in this nodule. And so the blood pressure was fine. The answer here is the metanephrines. You have to rule it a few. Again, remember, they are usually large, cystic, and have high attenuation on CT. So in the next 5 minutes, we'll quickly run through pituitary. Again, there's a lot of things that can show up as mass in the pituitary. Thankfully, most of these are benign, and most of them are small. So pituitary adenomas are described as micro if they're less than 1 centimeter, and most of these, thankfully, are. There's some infiltrative disorders that can also present as masses in the pituitary. So we need to know those. And then metastatic tumors, usually in the setting of diffuse metastatic disease. Widely metastatic disease may present, and again, lung, breast, kidney seems to be the common players here. So the frequency of these adenomas depending on the source. Again, autopsy series is a common way in which we assess for frequency, and in this study is about 10.7%. Again, most of these were small. Important thing, though, 40% of them stain for prolactin. So every patient with an incidental pituitary adenoma should have a prolactin done. The pituitary adenoma is third most common brain tumor, about 10 to 15% of all intracranial tumors. And the pituitary MRI is usually the best study to find these, and we mentioned the classification based on size. This is a normal pituitary. This is a pituitary adenoma. So this is a sagittal view. In determining the significance of these, we certainly want to assess if there's mass effect, hyperfunction, hypofunction. Some of these adenomas can present with apoplexy and hypopituitarism. One of our residents last year, I worked with her on one of our cases that was a gentleman who actually presented with a macroadenoma that ended up presenting with like a subclinical apoplexy. She presented at the AFCP meeting and actually got second prize. So pay attention to these cases. Posterior pituitary dysfunction often in the setting of those more infiltrative disorders that were on that other list. So pituitary tumor types, 40 to 50% are prolactinomas. So it's important that you get that prolactin level. And then the other group that's mentioned more commonly would be the non-functioning, although some of these, and these tend to be large on presentation just because they tend to go silent for so long and often present with vision field and hypopituitarism. And the next most common would be your growth hormone secreting and your ACTH secreting tumors. Very rare to find thyroid growth, but it can present, again, with pituitary mass. Patients that are found with these, you need to determine if they're having signs of endocrine hypo or hyperfunctioning. And, you know, the symptoms earlier we talked about for anterior and posterior pituitary, so signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism, hypogonadism, adrenal insufficiency. And again, you also want to assess whether or not they have signs of a mass effect. And hyperfunctioning, most often prolactin excess, but you definitely have to think of the other hormones as well. So the biochemical evaluation, you want to do your TFTs. Remember, it is not enough to just do TSH in a patient that you're assessing for pituitary, because the TSH may be normal inappropriately for that level of T4. So this is the setting you want to look at both. So a TSH alone is not enough as an initial screen in patients with pituitary adenoma. Clearly, prolactin you want to also measure. There's been an observation that some of these macroadenomas may have, usually the size of the pituitary mass correlates with the level of the prolactin. So tiny, small microadenomas will have not so elevated prolactins, but if you have a macroadenoma, that prolactin should be well over 200. Most of them, they're over 500. So if you have a macroadenoma and the prolactin is 150, this could be disinhibition, or it could be that the prolactin is falsely low because of the sheer mass of the elevation that's causing what's called a hook effect on the acid that they use. So we often would request them to repeat it using a dilution, because you could be missing a true macroprolactinoma in that setting. And again, you're going to assess gonadal function. Women tend to present earlier with these tumors just because the lack of their menses is often a pretty obvious sign. Men don't often pay attention to libido changes until these get pretty large. Again, you want to assess growth hormone excess with the IGF and ACTH for the adrenal, ACTH and cortisol. If these are abnormal, usually we'll do suppression tests to assess further for the autonomy. Don't ever want to send these patients to surgery, though, without making sure that a prolactin was obtained. And the reason for that is the primary treatment for prolactinomas, even the large ones, is dopamine agonist. So we wouldn't jump to send these patients to surgery first, unless they have acute mass effect that is threatening. So just another quick review of anatomy. The pituitary sits right here. We have the internal carotid artery, the cavernous sinus. This is the stalk. A lot of times when they grow upward, they impress on the optic chiasm. That's a coronal view, and this is a coronal view also showing large pituitary prolactinoma that actually shrunk quite well just with dopamine agonist. So these patients don't automatically need to go to surgery. But they do need to be on dopamine agonist lifelong, because a lot of times if you stop it, they regrow. So indications for therapy in patients with prolactinoma is clearly macroadenoma. If you have a microadenoma that's enlarging, oftentimes young women who have fertility concerns, you want to make sure you suppress that prolactin. Galacturia, that's troublesome, gynecomastia, and all the other gonadal functions. So just a quick overview, these patients that are hyperfunctioning, if it's prolactinomas, you're going to treat with dopamine agonist. If it's any of the others, you're going to do surgery or medical therapy. Surgery is usually first line. Certainly for patients with growth hormone excess that is incompletely treated with surgery, they may be treated with somatostatin analogs. And for patients with Cushing's, there are some other drugs out there that are used to suppress cortisol production and decrease peripheral effect of hypercortisolism, but surgery is generally primary. For the non-functioning nodules that are microadenomas, you're going to repeat the MRI, usually do it 6 months to a year for follow-up, and follow them for tumor growth. If they develop visual field abnormalities, then clearly they need surgery. For the macroincidentalomas that are causing symptoms of compression, you're going to send those to surgery. And if they're normal on follow-up, then you may do serial imaging, usually at minimum at six-month interval, and assess annual hormonal function. So quickly, pituitary case, 64-year-old woman seen for follow-up exam. 2 weeks ago, she was in a car accident. No injuries from the car accident. She's otherwise healthy. She's menopausal at 51. She has night sweats, as would be expected, occasional hot flashes. They have improved and are not bothering her. She's not sexually active, never took hormone replacement, no change in vision, and no galactorrhea. Physical exam, blood pressure is stable. She has a little elevated BMI. She has no axillary or pubic. She has axillary and pubic hair loss. Vision field is fine. No suggestion of Cushing's or acromegaly. These are her labs. She's hypogonadal. LH and FSH are inappropriate for this most menopausal age woman. And her prolactin is elevated. So remember, prolactin will suppress GnRH and will lower LH and FSH as a result. Thyroid function is normal, and again, you want to look at both TSH and free T4. So the question is, well, she did an MRI of her pituitary, and she has a 7-millimeter adenoma, and it's not invasive, doesn't approximate the active chiasm, and her stalk is midline. And the question is, what is the most appropriate management? And in the interest of time, we'll just jump ahead. Again, do you treat her with radiation? No, that's aggressive. Do you send her to surgery? No. So in this patient, you're going to just do repeat testing. If it was a younger woman who was not menopausal and had fertility concerns, clearly the dopamine agonist would be the choice. So look at the clinical history carefully and before making your choice. So I'm just almost at the end. For the pituitary take-home points, patients with pituitary adenomas, you want to evaluate for mass effect, for hyperfunctioning. All patients, all hormone systems should be assessed to see if they're low, especially in macroadenomas. And treatment is aimed at restoring normal pituitary function, includes surgery, medications, and hormone replacement. This is very busy. It's all the things I talked about with the image studies, but I'm going to let you look at that. And TSH, again, you got to get that ultrasound, and fine needle is the test of choice. So this is it. I think I made it. Yes. Thank you. I don't know if we have time for questions. Yes. Well, he clearly needs an aldo-renin ratio. Whether or not his ADD medication will interfere with your metanephrine screen, but I would still at least get a baseline plasma morning metanephrine, total and fractionated. You can do either. I mean, I don't know how many of you do these 24 urines. To tell the patient to spend a whole day and collecting, it's fraught with errors if they don't do it properly. So it's the quickest, easiest thing to do. The key thing is the patient needs to be resting in a calm environment. If they rush to the lab and the phlebotomy is quickly jumping, you may get a false positive reading that's mildly elevated. But if it's 2 to 4 times upper limit of normal, that's not a false positive. So I would still get, it's just a quicker, easier test to do. But you can do a 24 urine total and fractionated metanephrines as well.
Would you do a CT with contrast?
Yes. But I would do it after I've done the biochemistry because of these incidentalomas, and you don't want to get distracted with that first. So I would do the biochemistry in that patient and then looking for secondary hypertension. Yes.
Maybe this is for Dr. Jenner in surgery. What is the reason for a total thyroidectomy in a unilateral case?
Well, again, depending on the particular type of cancer, thyroid cancer tend to recur locally in the neck. So if you don't leave any normal thyroid tissue, you lower the chance of recurrence. And it makes it hard to follow other than with serial ultrasounds. You can't really do scans. You can't do thyroglobulin if half the thyroid is there. So depending on the size. Now, nowadays, there's been some reports about us being too aggressive with these microcarcinomas. And there's even a school of thought that some of these tinier ones we can follow without doing any surgery. But if they have a 3 centimeter papillary thyroid carcinoma, because of the recurrence risk and the ability of being able to follow for recurrence, if there's half a thyroid in there, it makes it a lot harder because the markers that we would normally use to follow for cancer recurrence are not reliable with so much thyroid tissue left in. So if it's a tumor, a large tumor, you're going to do a near total and remnant ablation to facilitate that. Yes.
Sort of a comment and question. You know, the problem with the thyroid ultrasound in many of our centers, we don't get all the details.
I agree. And it's important that there's a reason why so many endocrinologists get certified on doing their own thyroid ultrasounds. I didn't learn when I was in training. One of my colleagues does, so we have it in our office. But a lot of endocrinologists are doing their own ultrasounds so that we can be more specific with looking for these findings. Okay. Oh, thank you for your attention.